The Food and Drug Administration is convening today's meeting of the Oncologic Drugs Advisory Committee under the authority of the Federal Advisory
Committee. It's a move that could save the health system billions of dollars, and it could soon be a reality.
What's at stake is my ability to get access to affordable medication. That's what's at stake.
I'm Mikan Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
So here's this population that never gets studied, responding dramatically at high rates very, very quickly.
We wanted to actually measure exactly what was going on in the
light. Brains are complex systems of connections, modulated by connections.
You are the only person in history of mankind.
And he used Lego mindstorms to build something
called a dedication.
Constantly refreshing the screen, looking at
it.
On today's show, we'll chase down vectors of disease in the form of daycare centers, we'll rate the usefulness of fitness devices, and we'll find out what people do in work bathrooms, other than, yes, the obvious. But first up, a pharma revolution of sorts. I'm talking about biosimilars. They're like generic prescription drugs, except for more complex biologic drugs that can't exactly be replicated. Think injectables used in cancer treatments. Last week, a federal advisory committee handed down its recommendations on the very first application for a drug of this kind in the U.S. Many are calling it a historic move. Alana Gordon was there and brings us this report on what the decision could mean for the industry, for providers, and for patients.
Confession, I've spent about 5 days putting together this story. Mark McCamish has spent 5 years at least preparing for this presentation.
It's a pleasure for me to be here today to represent the Novartis group of companies.
McCamish is with the Swiss drug maker Novartis. He and his colleagues trade off at a podium in the front left corner of a large conference hall at the FDA's headquarters in Silver Springs, Maryland.
This slide outlines the biosimilar development.
It's now my great pleasure to walk you through the clinical development.
And taking a look now to the numerical results.
This is a very comprehensive and quite extensive package.
That the biological activities are highly similar.
If I can go to the next slide, please.
They're trying to make their case before an advisory panel of 14 independent cancer specialists and a group of FDA regulators for why their drug, EP2006, should be approved for sale in the U.S. It's similar to Amgen's drug, Neupogen, that's used to fight infections in cancer patients.
Thank you very much. So we are a little bit ahead of schedule, but I...
A lot of people, industry reps, patient advocates, investors, are here listening to this, paying close attention to the evidence under review. Some came in for the day from Europe. Their suitcases are propped against the wall. That's because Novartis' drug application represents uncharted territory in the U.S.
Welcome to what I think is a historic occasion. This is the first application under our new biosimilar pathway that's being brought to an FDA advisory committee.
That is Janet Woodcock, director of the FDA's Center for Drug Evaluation and Research. She says the FDA is in the midst of shaping the standards and requirements for approving biosimilars. So what is a biosimilar?
That's a question that sounds a lot simpler than the answer is.
During a mid-morning break, I meet up with Jay Siegel. He's chief biotechnology officer at Johnson & Johnson and a former FDA regulator. Siegel says biosimilars are highly similar but not identical versions of biologic drugs. They're not exact replicates like generics because biologics tend to be more complicated.
In a simplistic sense, biologics are typically much larger molecules. They're usually made by living organisms. They may be like hormones, other types of proteins. Sometimes they're cells. They can be antibodies. Whereas most drugs are smaller chemical entities that can be synthesized in the laboratory.
Biologics make up a small but costly portion of the U.S. drug market. And it's for that reason Amy Leong, a patient advocate, came in for today's meeting from California.
What's at stake is my ability to get access to affordable medication. That's what's at stake.
Leong has rheumatoid arthritis. She was in a wheelchair for 5 years. She says biologics are often out of reach for patients.
In my field, in autoimmune inflammatory arthritis, it's at least $1,800 a month. Now, you want to pay rent, you want to pay food, you want to get your child through school, or do you want the drug that's going to hopefully make a difference in your disease and in your life? It should not have to be about that.
The hope is that, like generics, biosimilars could offer cheaper, just as effective treatment options for patients. They've existed in Europe for a decade, and they've led to a 20 to 30% reduction in drug prices. The drug that Novartis wants approved here in the U.S. has been sold in Europe for several years. So why isn't it already available here? Jillian Woollett, a consultant at Avalere Health, says Europe passed a law establishing an approval pathway for biosimilars a decade ago. That didn't happen in the U.S. until the Affordable Care Act took effect.
Here is the version printed out 24th of December, 09.
Woollett pulls out a copy of the law from her bag. Specifically, it's the 40-page section called the Biologics Price Competition and Innovation Act. It's so important, she's been carrying it around for reference for 5 years.
Yeah, it's a little bit yellow. It's a little bit dog-eared.
Woollett says this legislation gives the FDA the legal pathway to develop an approval process for biosimilars, similar to what happened for generics in the 80s.
So it was legislation that was anticipated to save money. So therefore, if you put it in the Affordable Care Act, both the timing was right, but also the estimate was a savings of $14 billion.
That's $14 billion over the next decade. Everyone in this room knows cost is a huge issue. The panel even talks about it. But their task is to determine whether this drug is similar enough to the original one to be given to patients.
So, discussion from the panel.
And the question is, does this confirm...
I wish I could tell you there was a lot of lively debate over this application. People in the room have a lot of questions about what kind of clinical benchmarks and analysis will be required of biosimilars, about how doctors and patients will respond, and about the state's role in regulating their use.
Yeah, did I see a hand over here?
But the issues this panel raised about this specific application were really minor.
Clinically, it is highly similar.
Dr. Waldman, do you agree?
Yeah, I'm going to go with my colleague on this.
So much so that after a brief back and forth...
I think we can actually move on to the vote.
Deb Armstrong, the committee's chair and an oncologist at Johns Hopkins, calls for a vote. And
Antonio Moreira, I voted yes.
Kathleen Neville voted yes.
I'm Dave Strancic, I voted yes.
All 14 recommend the FDA approve the drug.
Voted yes.
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 No abstentions, no votes.
I voted yes.
Again, Jay Siegel with Johnson & Johnson.
Well, I was surprised to hear, not to hear more discussion.
So why wasn't there?
But no, it was actually pretty straightforward.
Scott Waldman is a member of the committee and also chairs Pharmacology and Experimental Therapeutics at Thomas Jefferson University here in Philadelphia. Waldman says this first application was one of the best clinical packages he's ever seen. One advantage that future applications won't have is all the available clinical data this drug has from being used in Europe.
I think this is a pretty high bar to set, and that other compounds that come through are going to have to leap over this bar.
But what this panel recommendation does show is it is possible. The FDA is expected to make their final decision in the next few months. At least three other applications for biosimilars are in the pipeline. Number two on the list, a biosimilar for Johnson & Johnson's blockbuster Remicade, used for diseases like Crohn's and colitis and developed right here in Philadelphia. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. I recently flew to Germany, and during my flight, I thought about how expensive my ticket was and how bad the food was and whether I should watch Before Sunrise again or perhaps the bridges of Madison County. But I didn't even think for 1 minute about global warming and how much flying contributes to it. Every time you fly, you trash the planet, reads the headline of a new article by Christy Aschwanden. She is the lead science writer for 538, and she joins us now to talk about this. Hi, Christy. Thank you for being here.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
So every time I fly, I trash the planet. How so? What happens?
Yeah, so flying releases emissions. CO2, of course, is the one that most people are most aware of, but it releases these emissions up in the atmosphere where they actually do more damage than they would if they were released down on the ground. And that's one of the reasons that it's so problematic.
We've mentioned carbon dioxide. What else do planes emit?
Yeah, there are nitrogen oxides, sulfur oxides, this thing called black carbon, which is particularly bad.
And just how much emissions are we talking about?
Yeah, right now aircraft are about 2.5% of global carbon emissions, and that doesn't sound like that much. But it's growing very rapidly. And actually, if aviation was its own country, it would be in the top 10 emitters in the world.
So, you know, as an individual, if I think about reducing my carbon footprint, I think about not driving as much and perhaps not using air conditioning, those kinds of things. But I guess all of that is voided when I fly?
Absolutely. It's almost inevitably your biggest source of carbon emissions. So just to give you a sense of scale, taking a flight from Denver to New York round trip releases just under 2,000 kilograms of CO2. For that amount of emissions, I could drive my little Honda car 7,500 miles. But the bottom line is releasing these emissions up in the atmosphere creates much, much more warming effects than they would down on the ground. The IPCC, which is the sort of international governing body that looks at this stuff, the scientists, their estimate is that 2.7 is the multiplier they use, which means that it's about 2.7 times worse to release this carbon up in the atmosphere than it is down on the ground.
And Christy, all of this obviously begs the big question, which is, what can be done about this?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the answer is a lot, actually. The problem, though, is that the things that we can do don't match the magnitude of the problem. So in other words, there are a couple of approaches that can be used. One is fuels. So you can use biofuels and look at other sources of fueling the plane that would have less of a carbon impact. The problem, though, is that flying is an inherently very fuel-intensive activity. If you think about it, it makes a lot of sense, right? You're lifting this big, heavy object up into the air. And so that's just inherently going to take a lot of energy. And the other thing is you need a fuel that's very concentrated because of the weight aspect. So you don't want a fuel that's really heavy compared to the amount of energy that you're going to get out of it. So that limits things quite a bit.
Could planes be designed in a better way to be more fuel efficient?
One of the problems is that today's fleet is just much more efficient than it was 30 or 40 years ago. Planes last a long time. And so even if the planes become more efficient, a new plane can stay in the fleet for like 30 years. And then oftentimes the plane that gets retired from, say, American Airlines or United or one of the airlines here gets bought up by an airline in another country. And so it remains in the air. And so it just takes a really long time to make progress using this approach. So the other one that we haven't talked about is operations, and that is making flights, their takeoff and landings, more efficient, making sure that planes aren't flying around an airport waiting to land, things like that. That's another place where efficiency gains can be made. But putting all of these things together, so you have the technology of the planes, you have the fuels, biofuels, things like that, and you have operations, putting all of those together just does not come anywhere close to meeting the kinds of goals that the International Civil Aviation Organization, ICAO, is setting for reducing emissions. It's just an enormous gap. It's quite shocking, in fact. And ICAO recognizes this. This is why every single plan here to reduce emissions also includes something called market-based measures. Most people know them as carbon offsets. This is basically the aviation industry paying another industry or another source to reduce their emissions for them. So the idea is there's sort of a ceiling on how efficient aviation can become, and there's just a huge gap between that and the carbon goals. The only solution then is to find other sources of emissions reductions. And so that's why all of these treaties, all of these plans include an emissions trading system.
But bottom line, does it mean there will be fewer flights and they will be even more expensive?
If we are to meet the emissions targets that the industry has set, there will have to be fewer flights. That's how the numbers stack up.
And one last question, if I want to pick an airline that's kind of ahead of the curve in terms of being fuel efficient and green, or maybe that's the wrong word, which airline could I pick?
Yeah, so there was a study that came out recently looking at efficiencies among the U.S. fleet, and there was about a 27% difference between the most and least efficient airline. Alaska Air comes out on top, and American Airlines comes out dead last. But it's not just a matter of American Airlines saying, oh, screw it, we don't care about the climate, we don't care about this stuff. Alaska Airlines is based out of Seattle. The Seattle airport is part of a program called NextGen, which is working to increase efficiency of operations. And so we don't know exactly why their efficiency is the best, but some of the speculation is that being based out of a very efficient airport is helpful. They have some new planes. That's helpful, too. So this is stuff that's very important to pay attention to. But I'll just point out that you're talking about, which Hummer is less environmentally destructive.
Christy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Christy Ashwanden is lead science writer for the website 538.com.
A scrub is a guy that thinks he's flying, is also known as a buster.
Coming up on The Pulse, walk near a hospital and you'll see people out and about wearing scrubs. We'll meet a biologist who stops scrub wearers on the street.
I just ask. I don't sort of give my opinion. I say, I'm curious, are there any rules about wearing your scrubs outside the hospital, and what do you think about that?
Why the obsession with scrubs? We'll find out on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence believes in living like nothing can hold you down. But to live worry-free, you need someone to fall back on. That's why they offer doctors and hospitals across the region and a range of health plans designed to help fit your budget. Independence is here to help. This year, you may be eligible for financial support. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. More information at IBX.com or 1-800-ASK-BLUE.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca promotes health and science education and disease awareness through initiatives such as the Young Health Program, which helps young people build personal qualities to live healthy, successful lives. Launched in the U.S. in partnership with the United Way of Delaware, the Young Health Program has reached nearly 12,000 young people since 2012. More about the Young Health Program can be found online at im40.org.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. I'm at the corner of 8th and Walnut Streets in Philadelphia right now, and there are two major hospitals nearby. So I'm watching a lot of healthcare workers as they're coming from work, going to work, getting coffee, getting a bite to eat, and they're all wearing scrubs. That's how I know they're healthcare workers, because that's what they wear to work, obviously, but should scrubs be worn outside of the hospital? Or does that pose a risk for carrying germs in and out? I see you're wearing scrubs. Do you wear them when you go to work?
Yes.
So you take them home and then you wear them to work and when you leave?
I wash them. And
right.
I mean, it depends if I'm in a rush or not.
Your hospital doesn't have a policy about not wearing scrubs outside, right?
They do. You're really not supposed to.
Oh.
But they don't say anything when you arrive in your scrubs?
Mm-mm.
No. How come?
I don't know.
So nobody's ever said to you, don't wear these scrubs outside?
To me personally, no.
Hi.
Yes.
Hi. I see that you are wearing scrubs.
Today I didn't feel like dressing up, so I'm dressed in my pajamas, yes.
Are you concerned at all that that might pose a risk for infection or anything like that?
Not today, because I'm not doing any procedures today, so I'm just seeing patients like I would be wearing my ordinary clothes, so no.
I'm literally just walking one block coming in.
So where are you going right now?
Wawa.
Scrubs also go to Starbucks, to the movie theater, to restaurants, the subway. And all biologist Jonathan Eisen of UC Davis can see is traveling germs. Before we get into his reasons, a clarification.
Actually, I work hard against spreading germophobia.
Eisen is not a germaphobe. Germs are his life. He studies microbes, the good, the harmless, and the terrifying.
There's been a very rapid and scary increase in the abundance and frequency of infections from antibiotic-resistant bacteria, for example. And one place that we see a much higher frequency of those organisms is in medical care facilities, not surprisingly. That's where people go when they're sick, and there's also spread of these organisms inside medical facilities.
Eisen says the biggest concern with scrubs outside of the hospital is not so much bringing germs in, but carrying them out.
They actually get contaminated relatively quickly, so if you bring in a pair of new scrubs or new clothing of any type within, you know, 6 to 8 hours, they can get a reasonable number of microbes on them. That's not surprising. And of course, if there are antibiotic-resistant microbes in that environment, they will also pick those up. So the thing that we don't know a lot about is whether or not going outside the hospital after they have gotten contaminated causes any transmission of those microbes to other people.
So scrubs may collect lots of germs, but we don't know if that actually causes any problems.
There's really limited evidence, lack of data on the role of attire and the role of scrub attire in the transmission of organisms in healthcare settings.
That's Julia Sammons. She's medical director of the Department of Infection Prevention and Control at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia.
So I think until robust evidence exists or more robust clinical studies are done, our priority is really on focusing on evidence-based practices that include hand hygiene, the isolation of patients with communicable diseases, disinfection and cleaning of the environment, these things which have strong evidence behind them as reducing the spread of germs in hospitals.
I guess this bag I brought here when I take it back out could be just as germ-laden as a pair of scrubs, right?
So I think, you know, if you were to culture a number of different surfaces, whether it's clothing or surfaces in the environment, you may find germs on them. I think it's most important to remember in the healthcare setting, the primary way germs are transmitted are through our hands.
Salmon says CHOP only has specific policies when it comes to operating room scrubs and areas of the hospital where instruments are sterilized. Scrubs worn there cannot leave the hospital. But that's it.
As a general employee outside of the operating room setting, scrubs can be worn just like other clothing as sort of part of a uniform. Again, the general standard is that scrubs should be clean, and if they become visibly soiled or contaminated, they need to be removed and fresh clothing be put on in their place.
The American Hospital Association has no guidelines on this topic. All of the area hospitals I contacted seem to have scrub policies like the one at CHOP. Firm rules only apply to OR scrubs and some other specific areas of the hospital. Pennsylvania Hospital recently outlawed fleece garments because of their fuzzy texture and makes them more prone to collecting germs, and they also shed. It seems right now hospitals are focusing on areas where they know germs are being transmitted, like hands, and scrubs are simply not a priority. That irks biologist Jonathan Eisen.
So there's this big surface area, and it just seems as a precautionary principle that hospital and medical workers should try to do the simple things that can limit the possibility of spreading some organisms that you don't want to have spread. And it just seems that bringing scrubs outside of the hospital doesn't make sense as a common practice.
Taking a closer look at scrubs could bring up a lot of similar issues for hospitals. What about shoes, ties, cell phones, and the beloved white coat? But Eisen says with the exponential rise of antibiotic-resistant organisms, even if all of this wasn't a big deal in the past, it's something healthcare providers should think about in the future. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Actually, guys, I'm sorry. Can we stop down for 1 second? I have to use the bathroom.
Yeah, go for it.
I'm sorry. I'll be right back. All right. All right. Sorry.
Actually, I don't really have to go. I just wanted to eat a snack and maybe cry for a minute. Or take a quick nap. Do you think I've lost my mind? Those are all things American employees do in the bathroom, according to a new survey from hygiene product company SCA. And I'm going to go back into the studio and talk to Amy Belcourt. She's Vice President of Communications for SCA, and she'll fill us in on the details. All right, I'm going to wash my hands real quick. Amy.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
Oh, our pleasure. All right. Put my headphones on. So, Amy, what did this survey find? What do employees do in the bathroom?
Well, I think there were quite a few surprises about the types of things people do in the bathroom. Of course, they use it for biological reasons, but they're also using it for things you wouldn't expect, things like talking on the phone, texting. Okay, maybe sometimes you expect those things, about 25% of people, but also they're using it to eat, to cry, to exercise, and some people are even using it to sleep.
Why do you think that is? What did people speak about why they use the bathroom for those activities?
Well, we didn't ask them the whys, but as we've analyzed the research, we've made some of our own guesses, I guess, as to why people are doing this. First and foremost, we live in a highly connected society. I think people are looking for a sanctuary, a place to get away from it all. So there's that group of people that really do use it for those private moments to disconnect, whether it's a private space at work, to eat, to exercise, to express their frustration, and sadly, even to cry. But yet, there's that other group of people that are so highly connected, they're never going to put down their devices. So they're actually bringing those devices right in the restroom with them in the workplace, and they're texting and even talking on the phone in the bathroom. And I don't know about you, but I don't often hear people chatting on the phone, but sometimes I do.
Oh, yeah, I've heard that. Why does your company do these surveys?
SCA is a maker of the Tork brand of products, which are things like bath tissue, paper towels, soap, hand sanitizer that are used in workplaces. So we're very interested in how people use their workplaces, what they're doing in there, because we want our products to really help businesses to have the best restroom for employees.
What did people not like about their work bathrooms?
Oftentimes, it is the lack of hygiene. It is feeling like it's just not clean. This could be things like you've probably been in a bathroom where paper towels are flowing out of the wastebasket and onto the floor, or it feels like the toilets themselves have not been clean, or the sinks are wet and dirty and messy. Those are the types of things that really have a negative impact on people.
Did you hear anything in terms of privacy? A lot of times work bathrooms don't feel very private because you have stalls. So yeah. You see the other person's feet and you see people coming in and out.
We're actually finding just the opposite, that people view the bathroom as maybe one of the growing more private spots in work. You know, there's a real trend in office design toward the open office space. You know, people are, you know, it's a way to be more effective in how you utilize space, but it's taking away the doors and the walls. And so people are sitting in these big open spaces and finding very little privacy. We think that's why more people are doing these types of private things in the bathroom, particularly texting, talking on the phone, venting frustration, crying, all of those things, because you a lot of times you had an office in the past to do that. Now, you know, you're in this big open space, so you're looking for those private moments. And even though you can see the feet under the stall, it still feels more private often than the rest of the office feels.
So does this mean perhaps employers should have a cry nap lounge or something rather than having people do this stuff in the bathroom?
Well, some employers have expanded their restroom space to include couches or more private places. We saw this start originally with areas for nursing moms, where employers were eager to help nursing moms have a more private space. So employers are in some cases adding these, adding showers, adding couches or adding places to create that private space, but also to sort of have that resting space.
In terms of cleanliness of work bathrooms, what are employees most concerned about? Do they worry about picking up germs or illnesses, or what freaks them out?
It's interesting how in the United States, employees are not that concerned about the impact of hygiene on their health when it comes to their office environments. But in fact, they should be. The CDC says again and again that the number one way to avoid getting the flu, which we know is rampant this year, is through repeated washing of your hands throughout the day. But we found in our survey that about half the people who go to work never wash their hands once during the day. Yet your work environment is, you know, teeming with germs, and you're sharing surfaces constantly, whether it's door handles or computer keyboard or phone handle. You're shaking hands with people. You're using a copy machine that somebody used. You're using the microwave that somebody used. These are the places that germs live, and washing your hands repeatedly in the office can in some cases be more important than doing it at home. So we're finding that, you know, people still aren't getting that message. There are germs everywhere. People worry about things like the toilet seat. Frankly, your body is designed in a way to make sure you don't get sick from the toilet seat. Where you might get sick, though, is the phone, the microwave, the door handles, and shaking hands with your colleagues.
Any suggestions as to what employers could do about hand washing? You know, we see these signs in the bathroom. Yeah. Employees must wash hands before returning to work, but maybe those signs should be everywhere.
Well, one of the things you do here at the studio is you provide hand sanitizer for people when they're checking in. That's one thing employers can do. They can provide hand sanitizing stations around the office. They can also provide wipes, because people can wipe their keyboard. They can wipe their phone. You know, there are sanitizing wipes that have that component in them that will make it better. Keeping those signs up in the bathrooms is an important thing to do. They probably become invisible to most of us. But making sure it's a pleasant environment to wash your hands, that the soap is always full, that the paper towels are available to use. Another thing people can do, employers can do, is to put the wastebasket for the paper towels right at the door where you walk out. This means that you can use that paper towel to open your door and then you toss it in. In our offices, we also have a hand sanitizer right at the exit. So if you didn't toss your paper towel there, you can sanitize one more time before you walk out and face your colleagues.
Amy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mike.
Amy Belcourt is Vice President of Communications for SCA, which produces paper towels and other hygiene products. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Every year around this time, right in the middle of cold and flu season, parents with young kids seriously dread daycare syndrome. That's the revolving door of illnesses that forces parents to call in sick to work. Tanya English reports on this scourge of daycare families.
The colds and stomach viruses, they're real. But pediatrician Susan Aronson says so-called daycare syndrome, that's not really a thing. Sick kids happen, she says, in daycare and at home.
There's a tendency to blame that group exposure, but in fact, children who stay only at home with their families and siblings get most of those infections also.
Infants and toddlers who are cared for exclusively at home get about 6 to 8 respiratory infections a year.
If they go to a group care setting, they add another 1 to 2 on that.
Aronson wrote the book on this topic. It's called Managing Infectious Diseases in Child Care and Schools. She says some early education programs are too conservative about keeping kids at home.
There is no reason to exclude a child who is sniffling and sneezing, because, in fact, their biggest opportunity to share their organisms, their germs, was before they had any symptoms.
Aronson encourages parents to embrace the idea that children need to develop immunity to common infections. She counsels them to shake off guilty feelings and the tendency to think that kids catch coughs and sniffles only at daycare. Beyond that, she really stresses proper hand washing. Scrub between your fingers, the back and front of your hands.
And then once you've lathered well, to turn your fingertips down and let the water rinse all that stuff down the drain. And then don't touch the faucet handles.
To control germs, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the soaping up step should last at least 20 seconds. But getting a toddler to stay on task is tough.
Yeah, you can do bubble, bubble one, bubble two, bubble three, bubble four.
Lots of teachers and parents sing a song.
Wash, wash, wash your hands, sing a handy game. Scrub and rub and rub and scrub, germs go down the drain.
Lávate las manos, aquí, arriba.
When time's up, a buzzer goes off at the Maternity Care Coalition's Early Head Start.
Aquí.
At the South Philadelphia preschool, there's always a line to climb up onto the step stool.
Up, up, up. Okay, we're going to turn on the water.
Hand washing is the first thing kids do each day.
Oh, it's a little bit hot here. Okay, that's right. So got your hand, got your soap. Where's your soap? Okay, get it? Where's your soap? Over here.
Monica Coscardi is 2-year-old Hadassah's mom.
And you're set. Turn on the water. Yay. Okay. They're very, very, very clean in here. Okay, you're done. I make sure before she gets into the daycare. So it makes me like very, very safe to let her in here.
Are you okay, Joseph? Joseph, are you okay?
In Doris Young's toddler class, the kids aren't quite coordinated enough to cover their mouths with an elbow, so they use their hands.
I wiped his nose. He didn't touch it, but the germs could have gotten on him when he was coughing, so we're going to need to wash our hands.
Again. The changing tables and breakfast tables have to be sanitized before and after every use.
Michael, can you use your phone?
Fingers out your mouth, Nyla. No, thank you. Yummy. You want some more pineapples?
Everyone is still learning spoon skills, so lots of cereal bits end up on the table, then get picked up by sticky fingers.
If you don't get to them quick enough, they will eat them.
Early childhood development coordinator Jessica Smith says you could spend all day chasing germs.
If you're constantly washing your hands, sanitizing, disinfecting, when do you do activities with the children?
The center follows hygiene protocols from 3 different state and national groups.
We are a Keystone Star 2 facility in the process of becoming a Keystone Star 3 facility.
STARS is a Pennsylvania acronym for Standards, Training, Assistance, Resources, and Support. It's just one accreditation that the State Department of Human Services says parents should look for when they're shopping for childcare. At Early Head Start, the furniture, sheets, play clothes are all cleaned once a week. Some toys get sanitized at the end of every day.
So if a toy goes in a child's mouth, when the child is done playing with it, the teacher will put it in the dirty toy bucket.
To keep illness in check, experts say it's best if the same children and the same teacher stay together most of the time. That's called cohorting. Kids who eat and play together regularly encounter the same germs and build up resistance to each other's particular set of cooties. So the kids should stay together, but the newest safety recommendation is to keep their stuff separate to avoid spreading viruses, lice, and other things that get carried to daycare from home.
The children's hats, coats, gloves, and other belongings can't touch.
Lots of play schools take kids outside most days, and it's also good to open a window or have another way to air out the classroom to keep fresh air circulating. There's no such thing as a public registry where you can look up a play school's illness track record. But parents should spend time in a classroom and watch how teachers handle hygiene. Finally, a bit of good news for weary parents. Hang in there. By the time children reach age 3, they get sick with about half as many colds in a typical year. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
Coming up on The Pulse, don't be completely shocked when I tell you this, but getting a fitness tracker doesn't necessarily make you a healthier person.
I had one and it broke, so I stopped using it.
Making fitness technology really work for more people. That's next on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse and believes that everyone should make the most of every moment. That's why they offer doctors and hospitals across the region and a range of health plans designed to help fit your budget. More at IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Actively supporting nonprofit organizations to increase disease awareness, prevention, and access to medicines in the Philadelphia region, AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. Learn more by visiting AstraZeneca-US.com.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Fitness trackers, devices, may do a decent job of, tracking your daily fitness, counting your steps, or monitoring heart rate, but do they actually change human behavior? Can they keep people motivated enough to break bad habits that stand in the way of being healthier? We could ask my Fitbit, which has been sitting in my underwear drawer for about a year, but there is more scientific information on this topic in the form of a new article in the Journal of the American Medical Association. And innovation reporter Todd Bookman joins me now to talk about all of this. Hi, Todd.
Hi, Mike.
So it isn't about which gadget I should buy, right, or which one is the best?
No, the article is much more big picture. It's more about fitness trackers' potential for large-scale impact. The lead author is Mithesh Patel. He's a physician at the Philadelphia VA Hospital. He's a professor at Penn, and if that isn't enough, he's also got an MBA.
So, you know, I'm a behavioral economist and healthcare researcher, very interested in figuring out how we can develop strategies to help improve the health of the population.
So he's talking about population health. Do lots of people have these gadgets?
Well, that's one of the issues. Somewhere between 1 and 2% of Americans already have one. That's obviously a lot of people overall. But they aren't necessarily getting to enough of the folks that may benefit the most. The likely user right now is young, tech-savvy, high-income. Patel would like to see the prices come down so that more low- and middle-income people can get their hands on them, and that would expand their reach into groups more likely to have chronic health problems. Patel also sees another issue with the technology. As smart as the smart gadgets may be, they're not actually all that straightforward to use, and that can scare some people off.
You have to use the wearable device, which means wearing it, recharging it, carrying it with you everywhere you go, and oftentimes syncing it to another computer or laptop. And these are additional behaviors from people that may already have challenges changing their behavior.
Right, and if they're wonky to use, they eventually end up in the drawer, just like mine, right?
Yeah, next to your Tybo VHS tapes, your shake weights. Patel cites a study that found half of people who buy a wearable stopped using it. A third of them did so within 6 months. But he told me, even if you can get people to keep using them, just having more data about how many steps you took or your heart rate during a workout, that doesn't automatically translate into better health. Patel says there need to be smarter, what he calls engagement strategies.
There are examples of many employers that are giving their employees Fitbits. And one of the things that is a common mistake is that just giving people Fitbits or other wearable devices themselves is not going to motivate people. Designing incentives or designing reward strategies or workplace competitions can really help people to get engaged.
Workplace competitions, that sounds a little bit like high school. A little scary.
Were you not picked first, Mikan?
Never.
So Patel says workplace competitions, they can be better structured so that you don't alienate people who are new to athleticism. For example, you can pool people into teams. Another idea he likes outside of the workplace is better integration of social media, which some wearables already do offer.
So by posting a message about how much activity you had or whatever behavior you're tracking, that can help to make you more accountable for that because you're telling other folks. You can also get peer support when people provide positive feedback or reinforcement to that. So I do think that there's a role for that. Now, the exact role, again, has not been well studied, and that's something that you know, I think needs more work.
So that's when you post your stats on Facebook or Twitter and you annoy all your friends who are binge-watching some show on their couch,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. But, you know, on all these issues, I don't see Patel as necessarily being critical of wearables. I think the paper is more of a challenge to the device designers and also HR departments, health providers, nonprofits. They've all got to figure out better ways to incorporate fitness devices into our routines. You know, in order to change human behavior, you've got to first understand it.
So it's a tool with potential, but we have to learn how to use it.
Like most technologies, there's a life cycle to this. Just getting them isn't enough. You've got to figure out its strengths, weaknesses, and how to best use it.
Todd Buchman, thank you so much.
Thanks, Mankin.
And some more health news. A new study has found genetic differences that may help people choose the quit smoking tool most likely to work for them. Turns out some people break down nicotine slowly while others process the chemical faster. University of Pennsylvania researcher Karen Lerman conducted this study, and she says these differences may become a biomarker, a way to personalize help. She explained that it would be best for smokers to choose the optimal treatment approach the first time they try to give up smoking, because each time a smoker attempts to quit and fails, it affects their confidence and perhaps their motivation to try again. The new study found that normal nicotine metabolizers were more likely to stay off cigarettes by using the medicine varenicline. Lerman says some smokers may be genetically programmed to respond better to those pills, which are sold under the brand name Chantix, in comparison to nicotine replacement patches. Smoking cessation experts say this research fits into a growing understanding that treatment for smokers has to be individualized.
Time takes a cigarette, puts it in your mouth. You pull on your finger, then another finger, then cigarette. The water wall is calling, it lingers.
You're listening to The Pulse. Learning science can be complicated, and students often use graphs or other tools to understand complex problems. But what if using these visual tools isn't an option? This week in our series Patient Files, we hear from a local student who says that you don't always have to see what you're learning in order to understand it.
My name is Hayden Dahm, and I'm a senior engineering student at Swarthmore College, and I also happen to be blind. My twin brother Ethan and I were born over 3 months premature, and we suffered a series of health complications as a result of that. Fortunately for me, the only lasting complication I have was becoming legally blind. Legally blind means that I had some vision, it just wasn't very good. But then as I got older, especially at the end of eighth grade and then throughout high school, the vision in both my eyes gradually declined. And so by the time I graduated high school, I was at a point where I really didn't have functional vision in either of my eyes. So I had to enter college and learn new tools for how to function as a blind student. I use a program called MATLAB that is intended for engineers and scientists. It's commonly used both in academia and professionally. What I've done with the assistance of some of my professors is to create a program that can convert visual data plots into sound. So what this does is it takes a regular graph that you might have where you have two axes and there's a curve that is described by the variables on those axes, and it converts it into a function of time. So no matter what I'm showing, the independent variable will be time, and the dependent variable is the pitch of the sound that my computer is producing. What I'll be playing for you is an example of where having the sound plot was hugely helpful. A few weeks ago, I had to hand in a homework problem. I thought I had it correct, but I thought, you know, I should just double check it with my sound plot. What I heard instead was that it started off extremely low and this went up exponentially, which is not at all what should have been happening. I went back to my code and realized that I was missing a couple minus signs, put them in, and everything was right. So it almost sounds like a siren. To my knowledge, I'm the first blind student to study engineering here at Swarthmore College, but there is definitely a precedence for engineers who are blind. One of my favorite examples going back in history somewhat, is that the man who invented cruise control for automobiles was actually blind. The story goes that he was going on a ride with his secretary, and he was very frustrated by the way his secretary would constantly speed up and slow down when they were on the highway. So he went off and he worked on inventing cruise control so that there would be more consistent velocity. So just because you can't see the technology doesn't mean you can't understand it. A while back, I had someone ask me, well, Hayden, why did you choose to do engineering when doing something like English or sociology could have been a lot easier, where it's just text, aren't all these equations and diagrams? To be honest, that question hadn't really even occurred to me before. I wanted to do engineering, and just because I'm blind doesn't mean I can't pursue that dream. It just means I have to pursue that dream sometimes in a slightly different way.
Hayden Dom was recently awarded the Marshall Scholarship to study in the UK. He hopes to help develop sustainability technology to combat climate change. Great Tennis produced this piece.
I never can say goodbye. No, 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 I never can say goodbye.
Check it out.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Joel Patterson, the associate producer. Megan Pinto is our executive producer. Chris Atulo is vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey, the chief content officer. If you missed some of this show while you were in the bathroom, perhaps, or any of our previous shows, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And we always love to hear from you. Email us with your feedback, your ideas, your questions at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike Enstadt. Thank you for listening. Break, 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 break.